This is the I Read Comic Books podcast. I am your host, Mike Rappin. With me this week are two amazing people, Paul Jaisley.
Hello.
And Nick White.
Hey.
Thank you both for joining me this week. I'm still somehow sick, so I apologize for snorts and weird noises that my body may make. But let me ask you guys the question that I ask every single week. How have you been? How have comic books been? Let's start with you, Nick.
I guess we know how Mike's been now. We sort of have the short answer to that. How have you been? I'm a wreck.
Accurate.
Things have been good. I mean, I suppose you're asking, you know, what's going on in my life outside of Animal Crossing Pocket Camp, which is, you know, life is what happens when you aren't playing Animal Crossing Pocket Camp. That's what John Lennon meant to say. Yeah, exactly.
I see.
For those not aware, get into it. It's on Android. It's on iOS. It's been great fun because, you know, it's supposed to embrace the spirit of camping, you know, stargazing and roasting marshmallows and all of that other stuff that comes along with it. And just despite Xander, I've been buying like TVs and computers and like big luxury couches for my camp and then sending him pictures of like me more or less attempting to like defy the general feel of camping. So that's been great fun.
It's really a lot of fun when you send those pictures in the group chat. I appreciate it.
And then Xander just gets so furious. It's great. So yeah, that's a lot of fun. Beyond that, you know, I've actually gotten around to doing a good amount of reading. For starters, I read Super Sons number 8. I guess if you had to have a theme for like my reading this week, it's sort of books that were kind of waning and having issues, but for some reason having issues, no pun intended, but have somehow found a second life in one way or another. And I feel like you don't see that as much anymore. Books maybe, you know, there's such an emphasis on starting strong that like when a book starts to taper, it really takes like a drastic reboot or a team change or something to really shift gears correctly.
Right.
But
right.
Super Sons kind of added a new dimension by sort of having a lot of interactions now with the Teen Titans, which ultimately results in a age-accelerated Robin. So you've got like this grandpa-looking Robin running around because this Time Master fellow, you know, super ages him. And that was a lot of fun. And you're really starting to see the two main characters, you know, Damian and is it John Kent?
Yeah, Jonathan.
It's John. Okay. Yeah. Really grow. And John is starting more to like trust his abilities and his powers and understand that maybe the most, you know, powerful ability he has is his mind. Okay, maybe that's like his 12th most powerful ability probably, but
he is Superman's son, like what do right. you expect?
Yeah but like I can't even remember now. I know at least at the beginning of the book he couldn't even fly. He could just sort of, as Superman started, you know, he could leap leap large bounds with a I'm just going to butcher it all today. And and you know, Damian is learning that maybe he doesn't need to micromanage everything to be a leader. So there's character growth. I'm really enjoying that. Also really enjoying that you know, Jorge Jimenez continues to be on art. The skeptic in me sort of figured maybe by now he'd be gone, but we've been lucky. So I read XO, as in XO Man of War number 8. This is the first issue drawn by Clayton Crane. For those unaware, Clayton Crane did team up with Matt Kint, the author in the past. They teamed up for 4000 AD, and they also teamed up for Rye. And this is a really good team up because the one thing that Clayton Crane does really well, if you ever see his art, is it all has this weird glossy liquid metal reflective sheen. Like yeah. that would be like the, you know, skills and abilities profile on his like LinkedIn page, you know, liquid so glossy, good. You know, metal reflective sheen, you know, check mark. I've got this, you know, 7 people have recommended you for this. That would be his specific attribute. And it works really well for EXO because the emphasis of the recent EXO arc has been, Eric of Dacia's increasing reliance on the armor, also known as Shannara. And so you've just got this beautiful, beautiful, beautiful looking armor. It's also good because this book is sort of moving back more towards an action feel and less of the, you know, talky-talky Game of Thrones. Here are eight different factions representing all these different people sort of feel. So the book's pace has kicked up a bit. And yeah, I mean, whenever I see like Eric in the armor now, like all I can think of is just applying like the, you know, U2 song With or Without You, like in the background, because I feel like that's like that's like the ongoing theme of Exo Man of War. And it's like, you know, this reliance on the armor. So that's just me arbitrarily, you know, applying soundtracks to books.
So before you move on, yeah. I think when you catch up on this book,
yeah, I think just I'm have one a back. Conversation. Yeah.
I know, you're only one back. I'm just saying, when you catch up, I want to have a serious discussion with you about this book, because there's a huge question that has been on my mind, but I don't want to say it now on the show, lest I spoil the issue number 9, and I don't want to do that for you. So
okay.
When you get past that, let me know, because I want to talk to you about it. Just
okay.
There's a whole big, like, philosophical question about this book that I have for you that I think you would know because you've read more Valiant, you've read more Exo than
yeah,
I,
sure.
So maybe you can answer it.
Yeah, that's an excellent idea. I'll just show myself the door. quick few other just quick hits here. Skin and Earth number 4 really falls into the same thing I've been talking about. A series that is a 6-issue miniseries from the musician / artist Lights, the electropop Canadian artist. For only 6 issues, the first 3 were very slow, very like kind of just ambling about, really just people hanging out with other people, and yeah, this current world sucks, doesn't it? Yes. And it was like, you know, the neurotic part of me was like looking at my watch and like, you have, you know, time's a ticking, you've got 3 issues, people, like let's go somewhere with this, come on. And yet what I didn't really realize is that the book was actually doing a very slow burn world building experience. You know, a lot of books are like, all right, let's put all the world building in one issue, and of course that pisses me off too. So this was just more of a slow burn. We're actually starting to see this book go places now, but it's a really interesting sort of experiment, obviously, because it ties in with her most recent album of the same name, Skin and Earth. And I would definitely encourage people to go check it out, especially because she's, as far as I understand, she's been largely self-taught for all of this. And so a lot of the issues have like, you know, how did I learn how to use this program? How did I learn how to do this? And so from someone who's like, you know, I just sort of decided to do this, it's an interesting perspective. Finally, I did read like 1 or 2 Star Wars things. I'll just say this. Poe Dameron, Volume 1. I know I'm late to the party. I know Charles Soule, Phil Noto drawing it. Absolutely beautiful book for people who actually want some Star Wars narratives that are more based around the current trilogy that's going on. This is a wonderful book. It's got all of Poe Dameron's charm. It's got all of BB-8's sassiness and noises. I want a book based on the droid gang from this book. There's like a droid team up heist thing that goes on between all of the X-wing pilots droids. I want that. I also love that Duros is actually a hero in this book. For those who have read it, the Duros is the technician of their squad. He's the one that flies the A-wing. And I'm glad that this alien profiling in the Star Wars universe is like ending. Like, okay, some Ewoks and Wookiees are gonna be like bad dudes, okay? It's possible. Not all Ewoks and Wookiees are, you know, I'm sure there's a couple real assholes amongst a bunch, okay? In the same vein, not all Dvornians, Duros, and Quarrens are bad dudes, okay? So let's stop the Star Wars universe alien profiling, all right? Like, that just
this,
a suggestion.
This book is doing that. It's they're trying to.
It is doing that. Yeah, I appreciate
doing that.
That
with Poe Dameron.
Yeah, exactly. So that's pretty much what I've read. What about you, Paul?
Well, I actually read a lot of stuff this week. Most of it was rereading Doom Patrol, the Grant Morrison Doom Patrol run. It's probably, if I had to guess, maybe the fifth time I've read this run all the way through.
Oh, wow.
It's one of my favorite comics, and it's great is going back and revisiting it after a couple years. It still holds up. So this is the Doom Patrol written in the late 80s, early 90s, written by Grant Morrison. Artwork for most of it by Richard Case. And yeah, I don't know if you haven't read it by this point, you really need to track it down, because revisiting it, it just reminded me just how great of a book it is and just how long planned Morrison's run is. There's stuff that happens in these issues that I remember happening way later in his run. Then you see, like, having read it a couple of times, I can see all the seeds and all the ideas that he's kind of introducing right away that'll pay off down the road. So I know, Mike, you're reading some of this stuff too, so I'm excited to talk about it with you at some point.
Yeah, I've been slowly making my way through volume 2. I don't know why. I've been reading it like issue by issue.
Yeah.
I really need to, like, what I did with the first volume was just, I just flew through it. I really need to do that with the rest of it, because it requires some connection, especially since I'm not familiar with it and it's all new, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, yeah.
I remember I did that with his Animal Man run and it really paid off to do that. So maybe I'll try to push through that this week.
Yeah, for those of us who are like seemingly bad people and are considering reading the new Doom Patrol first, like, is that like okay / probably not recommended / definitely not recommended?
Here's my mini soapbox discussion about this topic, okay?
Okay.
There's something about going into a comic and being surprised and being kind of lost that I really, really value and enjoy. And I think Grant Morrison and I think Gerard Way, as a sort of student of Morrison, tries to craft comics where you don't know exactly what's going on and it's up to you as a reader to kind of figure it out, because they loved that as kids, that feeling. So they try to do that with their comics. So on one hand, if you've read Grant Morrison's Doom Patrol, there's a lot of stuff in the new Gerard Way Doom Patrol that is a payoff or an homage to it. Mm-hmm. But if you come to it clean, you can still enjoy it on its own.
It's equally disorienting.
Right. And I think, they're not trying to be confusing on purpose. I think that they're trying to recreate that feeling of like when you were a kid. When I was a kid, I would buy comics off the rack at the supermarket, and you'd get issue 5, issue 17, issue, like, you didn't have a complete run.
Yeah.
But that was kind of fun of it, was just being lost in this big world. And I think for both those writers, that's really what they tried to do with their books. So you should read Grant Morrison Doom Patrol anyway, but I think you can read the new one with a clean slate, without any previous knowledge.
Okay.
Yeah. So I've been reading all that, digging through that. I also read a bunch of Batman comics this week. I know that's a big surprise. That's my thing.
Newsflash.
I read Batman Creature of the Night number 1. This is the 4-issue miniseries written by Kurt Busiek, art by John Paul Leone. This is my pick of the week a couple episodes ago, and it's even better than I expected. This is the sort of real-world take on Batman, where Batman is a fictional character but doesn't really exist. There's a young boy in the late 60s who absolutely loves Batman, loves the Adam West TV show, loves Batman comics. His name is Bruce Wainwright. And his parents get killed by a mugger on Halloween night, and it's all about how he deals with that, and it's a lot about how the character Batman can help a kid deal with that, but there's a great twist at the end that introduces something more sinister as a result. So really enjoyed that. And it actually inspired me to dive into my archives here and through my old long boxes and find my copy of Detective Comics number 500. This is cover dated March of 1981. It's a big oversized anniversary issue, 7 different stories and creative teams in here. And it has one of my very favorite Batman stories of all time, To Kill a Legend, written by Alan Burnett, art by Dick Giordano. And this is basically a sort of one of those sort of Elseworld type stories that you could do in the pre-crisis days. So the Phantom Stranger shows up and he tells Batman that there are alternate worlds, one where your parents died 40 years ago and you became Batman, our world where your parents died 20 years ago and you became Batman. There's also a world where your parents are just about to be killed and you can go save them. And Bruce Wayne, Batman, says, well, I have to go do that. I can't let my parents keep dying.
Oh, man.
And I can't let another 8-year-old deal with that. Like, I can't let another kid suffer the way I did. So they travel to alternate reality. And they have a couple days to track down Joe Chill. In the meantime, Robin goes to the library and figures out that this world has no superheroes. There's no Batman, no Superman. There's no heroic fiction. There's no Arthurian legend. There's no Zorro. There's no heroes. So Robin says, well, maybe this kid's parents, maybe Bruce Wayne's parents have to die so this world will have a Batman, will have a hero.
So nice one, Robin.
It all comes to a head where, like, Robin's like, oh, I can't let innocent people die no matter what. They stop the mugger. And then the twist, spoiler alert for a 36-year-old comic.
Yeah.
The twist at the end is that even though Batman saves Bruce Wayne's parents, Bruce Wayne, who's a spoiled rich kid, is inspired by Batman and starts reading Sherlock Holmes books and starts training physically and starts, he will become Batman, but without having suffered the pain that Bruce Wayne did in our world. It's a great story. It's actually one of my favorite Batman stories. If you can find a copy of it, it's a great read.
That's great.
Speaking of Batman and perfect Batman stories, Batman Annual number 2, this is by Tom King, Lee Weeks, Michael Lark on art, colors by Betty Breitweiser and June Chung. This was a perfect Batman story. And even if you're not reading the main Batman series by Tom King, go pick this up because it's a great standalone story. It's all about how Batman and Catwoman, their years ago, how they sort of, you know, fell in love without acknowledging it. It's all about their courtship in a weird way where she keeps breaking into Wayne Manor and he keeps catching her. And but there's the thing is there's a great ending. The epilogue of this book, and I won't spoil this one because it's not 36 years old.
there's a great off the press.
Exactly. There's a great epilogue which feels like an Elseworlds type of story. Like there's something that you couldn't do in mainstream continuity, I don't think, as a writer, but everything else about this book falls into Tom King's run. So I'm very curious to see how this is going to, if it will pay off at some point in his run, or if it's just like a one-off alternate reality type story. But it feels like it's in main continuity, but it, boy, oh boy, he goes somewhere where I did not expect.
man, I could do a whole mini-sode about Batman 36 and Batman Annual number 2. Like,
Do Lark and Weeks share art duties, or how is that broken down?
No, Weeks and Breitweiser do the main story, and then sort of the epilogue ending stories by Lark with colors by June Chung. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, I read 36 as well, Mike, and boy, oh boy, that another perfect Batman comic. This is a great week for Batman comics.
Totally. Totally.
Well, I'm over here saying I just finished War of Jokes and Riddles, guys. I've got the Joelle Jones arc sitting on my shelf. Jokes and Riddles. Is it weird that I found that kind of a little underwhelming? I don't know. On one end, I saw the ending of that underwhelming. On the other end, the idea that, and how do I couch this vaguely enough, that it was over something seemingly so petty was also oddly fitting for someone who was obsessed with those sorts of things. Does that make
here
sense?
You know what, we can let's talk about this in the break and we'll put it after the credits for anyone that wants to be, you know, who has read it and is fine with spoilers. How about that?
Yeah, that sure. Sounds good. Yeah.
Okay, all right.
I think the only other thing I read that I wanted to mention real quick was I also read Justice League number 34. This is the first issue by the new creative team, Christopher Priest and Pete Woods on art, and this is really great. It's kind of exactly what I wanted from a Justice League story. The main focus here is on Batman, which is maybe why I liked it so much. But Batman being being sort of overworked, and it ends up costing the Justice League something. Again, I won't spoil it too much, but Batman's overstressed, overworked. He slips up, he makes a huge mistake, and it's kind of implied, well, maybe you should take a break from the Justice League for a while. And it really feels like a change in tone from what I've been seeing from the Justice League for the past few years. And it reminds me of the Grant Morrison and Grant Morrison JLA in that sense, where it feels like a big story. I think Pete Wood's artwork is sort of stylized enough to make it look dynamic and exciting. So I'm excited for this new creative team on this book. So.
Did Woods do the main cover on that book?
Yes, he did.
Okay, yeah, it's definitely stylized. I'm going to go out on a real limb here and say that it's going to piss some people off. I think it looks interesting and great, but I think some people are not going to find his art very crowd-pleasing. But,
well, yeah, I mean, I mentioned the Grant Morrison run, and he had Howard Porter on art, and that was stylized at that time, too. And I want a Justice League book that feels different and feels unique.
Yeah,
and doesn't just feel like another superhero book. So I think this fits my aesthetic perfectly. So, yeah.
It's nice to have weird art on like flagship books. I mean, it pisses some people off, and maybe that's why I love it more. But and Christopher Priest on writing, that's great.
That's pretty cool.
Now going by Priest, apparently, from what Paul and I discovered yesterday. Yeah. He's just going by Priest now.
It's sort of pen name. Weird. So. Yeah. Well, Mike, tell us about what you read.
I've been kind of up and down. I've been super tired because I've been sick. So I didn't want to read a lot, but then Friday and Saturday I was like, fuck it, whatever. I'm going to read comic books all day. So I sat down and read kind of an array of stuff. Some of this I read earlier in the week, whatever, but I read Apartment Hunting, which is a Comixology submit book that I picked up just on a whim. I liked the cover, I liked the interior art. It's the most literal title ever because it's about someone who literally hunts apartments, like with a gun.
Oh, you do mean it like that? Oh, wow! Yeah.
Like with a gun. It is. Wow. It's a really weird book, not just from the concept. It is. It's got a strange kind of anticlimactic ending, but in a satisfying way. And that seems kind of weird, but I would recommend everyone check it out. It's kind of a cool concept. The way they play around with some ideas are kind of cool. It's really short. It's 22 pages. I think you can get it for $1 on Comixology. So check that out if you want something very odd that's new. I also read Delicious in Dungeon Volume 3. This is by Ryuku Kui, I'm going to say. This is a hard one, but this is my favorite new manga. It's about a bunch of adventurers who are traveling through a dungeon, and in order to survive, they have to eat the monsters and the plants that exist within the dungeon. Volume 3 features a giant kraken. Awesome. And in the previous volume, they ate a kelpie, which is essentially a water horse. Like, it's a horse that hangs out near pools of water and tries to drown you. So they kill it and they eat it. It's a really cool, like, very intricate book, and it's something that I would have never put two and two together for, but it makes a lot of sense. It's really well designed. Like, all of the animals and plants are very detailed. The cooking sequences are very, very specific, and you get all these cool little blurbs and cute things all over the place. If you're looking for like a new manga and you don't want to just read like teenage boys fighting other adults and monsters, this is a really cool, like, semi-adult oriented book about cooking, and it's got a fantasy twist to it, and that to me is like the best part. It's basically combining things that I never thought I'd love together. Like, cooking manga sounds cool, fantasy manga sounds cool, putting them together is perfect. It's a perfect mixture.
Do you learn like real cooking methodology as well? No. Just like all the other? Okay.
Well, yeah. to a certain extent, because there are some like things that you could apply. Like, they cook fish and they cook seaweed and they cook, you know, mushrooms and things like that, because these are also monsters, right? So they talk about, you know, how you would cut this thing up to say, oh, you want to make sure to cut out the barbs of this thing because you wouldn't want to eat that. And that would go the same for like a fish you would find. There is some like slight cooking inspiration, but I mean, like any manga, like, this isn't really directed towards how to teach you. This isn't a cookbook. It's just like a fun story. But they do this really cool thing where, and I think I talked about it on the show, where they, at the end of each meal, they show you what kind of benefit you're getting out of it, whether it be carbs or fat or protein or energy and so on and so forth. So it's really cool. Wow. Go check this book out. Like, if you could find it at the library, it is so fun. Yeah, it's a manga. You know, we don't get these types of books in the United States, unless you want to talk about Super Space Battle Lunchtime, but that's a different book.
I'm beginning to wonder if Mike actually read anything this week, or if he just hit the NyQuil PM a little too hard and
some sort of fever dream.
We're getting to sit through his hallucinations.
Yeah, I read three volumes of this real book. No, I just read one volume. Is the third volume? It's good. I also read As the Crow Flies. This is a book by Melanie Gilman. I didn't realize this when I backed it on Kickstarter, but it's the first part of an ongoing series. This is actually a webcomic. The story is about a young girl who's black and queer, and she goes to this Christian camp where it's a bunch of white girls hiking up this mountain to discover feminist ideals from way back when. And there's a whole bunch of discussion about, what does it actually mean? Is this like, is the purity that they're talking about really something that can apply to a person of color? It's a really interesting book that kind of had me thinking a lot as I was reading it. I really want to read part two because the end of volume one, while it ends a chapter or an act of the story, was very dissatisfying because I really wanted to know what the next literal page was going to be. So kudos to her for making me like drool for this book. But I was really bummed that it ended the way that it did because there's like, it's right on the cusp of a big story point. So I'm excited to see how the next volume comes. I don't know if there's going to be another volume or whatever. I'll just have to read it online or something, but it's very, very good. If you're looking for something that is kind of younger oriented, because I think this is something you could give to a teenager and they would really like resonate with it. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's very well done. Like heart, like the binding is really nice. The pages are, really beautiful, and it's all done in colored pencil, which I thought was really cool. Let's see, I also read Black Bolt number 8. Not too much to say about this book other than it's fucking incredible. Saladin Ahmed and Christian Ward have been killing it, and this book makes me sad, and I love that. It's constantly breaking my heart. finally, I did read Pluto, the Urasawa Tezuka Volume 1. This is a series, an 8-volume series written by Naoki Urasawa. It's based on Osamu... I'm going to try to not butcher all these names, I apologize. this is based on the Osamu Tezuka series Astro Boy, a.k.a. The Atom, I believe, or... Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think is the Japanese name. There's specifically based around the story arc The Greatest Robot on Earth, and the story itself is named after the arc's chief villain, Pluto. Now, it's not really a spoiler so much as... You are the story follows Gesicht, I think it's like a German name. He's a Europol detective who's one of the 7 great robots in the world. When a human and one of the great robots, Mont Blanc, are found dead with horns, in quotes, near their heads, Gesicht starts his investigation into what he believes to be a serial killer, specifically targeting the great robots of the world. This book's fucking beautiful. Urasawa's art is some of the best manga art I've ever seen. And Astro Boy shows up in Volume 2, but he is referred to as the Atom, which is his Japanese name. I cannot wait to read Volume 2. I have it sitting on my shelf. I'm so pumped. This book is fucking cool. It's like a noir detective story about robots that's based in an Astro Boy world. And like Astro Boy is super happy-go-lucky. And to think that they took this kind of dark twist and... In a dark storyline and like amplified it to its max level. From my understanding, the Greatest Robot on Earth story is pretty dark in that this monster is literally going around killing all of these various robots, and Astro Boy's on that list. So it's like a very serious story that happened very early in Astro Boy. Part of me is like, I'm going to finish this arc and then I want to go back and read that arc in Astro Boy just to see how they compare. Because supposedly they... Like, Urasawa does a fantastic job adapting this. And having never read Astro Boy, I'm really excited to get into that huge pantheon of stories and characters and stuff.
Yeah. So yeah, this is definitely one of the few manga that I've heard a lot of people talk about. It has a great reputation, and it's one that I should probably read at some point. So
yeah.
Yeah.
It's superbly, like, can't even get over how cool of a book it is. Just like a really good detective story.
Yeah.
Interesting. Anyways. Let's move on. Let's talk about comics that are coming out this upcoming week. Comic books are being released on December 13th, 2017. What are you guys excited for? I'm really excited for my picks. So, Paul, let's start with you.
I'm going to pick Mr. Miracle number 5. Obviously, it's Mr. Miracle. This book's been pretty much perfect across the board so far. But issue 4, without being too spoilery... added a whole new wrinkle to the New Gods mythology that I did not expect. And I really, really enjoyed that. Because I think most writers don't quite know what to do with the New Gods. They're tough characters to really do anything with. And I like that Tom King, on one hand, is doing a very simple, focused story about Mr. Miracle and Barda. On one hand, at the other hand, it's also this huge story about what happened to Darkseid and the Highfather and the overarching mythology of the New Gods, and this weird tension between those two focuses. And issue 4, you have Scott Free learn something about himself, which completely changes the character in a way. And I think that where they could go with that for the next 12 issues, or next whatever till the end of the run, and when it ends in 12 issues. could be really exciting and could actually do something fun and interesting with the New Gods, and it's been a while since anyone's done that. So this book's still perfect, and I can't wait to get my hands on issue 5.
For sure. What about you, Nick?
For me, it's me violating the rule and listing two books. It's regrettably, I know, it's not like these two books are like, gosh, these two books are going to be great, and I just can't pick. It's more like these are two issues of two books I normally like, and I'm kind of not that pumped about either, but not that pumped to an equal degree. So here we are.
so you have two half-hearted picks two that half-hearted, add up to one wholehearted pick.
You know what? That's probably the logic here. So you've got Grass Kings number 10. This is, of course, Matt Kint and Tyler Jenkins. And this arc of Grass Kings has been largely about telling origin stories of the people that live in the Grass Kingdom, with a little bit of a small forward momentum towards... Well, we're not going to talk about the other plot because obviously that's the big reveal of the end of arc one. So we'll leave it at that. But, you know, it's origin stories. It's fine. I wish there was more forward trajectory, but I get that, you know, Kint is trying to not overload us with exposition. And so it just comes... just sort of sprinkled out, you know, issue to issue. On the other end of this, you've got Bloodshot Salvation number 4. This, of course, is Jeff Lemire and Miko Suwayan. And this issue is largely about Rampage and his backstory. And he, of course, is sort of like the evil slash, you know, evil twin counterpart of Bloodshot that we really don't know that much about, at least in terms of the version that's been presented in the Valiant 2012 reboot. So I'm sure both will be good issues. I'm sure I'll be pleasantly surprised, but at least up front and from the one or two sentences I've read about each, I'm like, you know, okay, I'll probably like these, but I'm not like waiting, you know, on pins and needles, you know, to see what happens. So...
Gotcha. We'll catch up with you next time you're on the show, and you can tell us about how awesome these issues
hated
both were.
Both of them. No. What about you, Mike?
Oh yeah, for me this week, I'm excited about one book, and the other one I can't believe is actually a thing. the book that I'm actually excited about is Animosity number 11. This is Marguerite Bennett and Raphael de la Tour. I'm sorry. This book is... Animosity is an interesting book because I never want to read it. I never want to actually sit down and read this book. But every time I do, it pulls me back in and I'm like, give me the next issue. Like, I really need to bank issues on this book because I never feel like the urge. Like, I'm never like really excited. Like, yeah, another issue of Animosity's out. But after every single issue, I'm just like, hell... to the yeah, what else is happening? It raises so many questions in my mind about what is a being with thought? Because, you know, this is the book mm-hmm. that if you don't know what Animosity is, this is the book where one day something happens we don't know, and all of the animals on Earth suddenly gain the ability to speak and act with the same intelligence as humans do. So, you know, there are smarter animals and there are dumber animals, just like there are smarter humans and dumber humans. But on the whole, all of the animals on Earth can now speak and can now, you know, you do complex actions and they have context and they act as if you, like a person would act, which is interesting. So there's constantly a lot of questions. And in this most recent arc, they introduce this concept, and this isn't really a spoiler, but there is a colony of bees that are hanging out inside of this barn or hanging out outside of this dam, and without going into too many details about it, but there's the bees themselves have sentience to a certain degree. No individual bee has complete sentience.
It's a hive mind.
A hive does. Mentality. Yeah, it's a hive mind sort of, and it kind of like begs this question of like, well, they're just insects. What does that mean? You know, and one of the big problems that this book runs into, or at least the characters in this book run into, is that a lot of animals rely on meat. So what do you do when you want to eat something like a rabbit, but that rabbit is as smart or as sentient as you are? Mm-hmm. So it, like I said, it raises a lot of questions. It makes you think a lot about like you, your humanity. It makes you think a lot about how you treat animals and other individuals and even bugs, which too, I'm like, even a mosquito, like,
yeah,
kind of, it's interesting. So Animosity number 11, I'm excited. The current arc is very good. I don't want to, there's no real details to go to discuss about it. I just wanted to talk about this book for a second because it's always a good book. It's always a good read. And I have to credit Marguerite Bennett for being able to do that every month, because I don't think a lot of books have that. I can't say there was an issue of this book that I disliked. So kudos to her. The other book that I wanted to just quickly mention, because I cannot believe it fucking exists, is How the Trump Stole Christmas, number one, from Antarctic Press. I don't know if this is a one-shot. It's the cover is unbelievable. You should go look it up. It's fucking insane. I just can't believe it exists. Jeez. Or will exist. So,
Merry Christmas, everyone.
I don't know if you can, Mike, if you're still being surprised by things in the year 2017, I don't know what to tell you. So.
Our show this week is an interesting topic because, you know, movies are always really fun. So we're going to talk about comic book movies that you maybe didn't know were comic books. And now that's our clickbait title for the episode. But really what we want to talk about here is, when do comic book movies work? When don't they work? And specifically, we want to talk about non-superhero films, because I think we could spend all day talking about the Marvel franchise, the DC franchise, and we don't want to do that. You've got 100 other podcasts out there that are talking about that. What we want to talk about today instead is those books that are really, really cool, and they get adapted, and you go crazy because it was your indie fave. It was something that you never would have thought could have been adapted, and yet it was. So we've got a huge list of movies. Nick did some actual research for this episode, so kudos to him.
I went to Wikipedia. Let's just call it what it was.
Yeah, let's. Okay, sure. Nick went to Wikipedia.
Yeah,
I didn't. So I will say you did more research than me.
Sure.
But I guess, so just to think, you know, when we think of a lot of these non-superhero movies, things that come to mind for me are some that, Nick, you have listed, so I'm going to steal some, but like Pilgrim, Ghost World, Jonah Hex, Judge Dredd, The League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, all of these movies are actually based on comic books. And what's interesting is that in some of these cases, they follow the book to a T, and in other cases, like for something like Sin City, or maybe a 300, they follow the book to a T, like panel by panel even.
Visually as well as narratively, yeah.
Yeah, and in other movies, they don't follow the book at all. They use it as a very weak basis, and then they make the story whatever they want. So, yeah. Or I guess weak starting point. Thank you. So, I guess when does this work? When doesn't it work? Paul and Nick, I know you guys both have thoughts on this. So maybe we'll start with you, Paul, because you had an argument in the break that I really liked.
Yeah. Well, I've always held that the best or most successful for my tastes, and of course that it's all subjective art forms, but. But I think the most successful...
It's not. Paul's right. Okay, whatever I'm he right. thinks the rest of you should be getting in line with. He told me this during the break.
The most successful comic book adaptation from a comic to a movie, I've always said, was Ghost World, because it actually captured the tone and pacing of the comic in a way that most superhero comics just can't, you know? So our superhero movies can't.
You're and also biased because it's got Steve Buscemi and Thor Birch in it. Come on.
And I love Daniel Klaus. I mean, Daniel Klaus is one of my favorite cartoonists. So if you haven't read the original Ghost World, what's interesting is that in Daniel Klaus's Ghost World story, it's a very short story, but Steve Buscemi's character in the movie, he only is on like one page of the actual comic. He's a very small part, very minor character. And I think what makes the movie successful is that their ability to take a short story and turn it into a feature-length film by adapting it. Because there's no... They're not going to have fans of Daniel Klaus on Twitter complaining that the characters don't look like they do in the comics, or it's not the right actors. You know, it's just... there's not the expectations of being true to the comic the way there are with a lot of superhero movies. I mean, we should say that Thor Birch does look exactly like the character Enid Koslaw. They somehow managed to luck out in that sense, but...
Yeah.
But I think what makes that movie so successful is that you can watch it without any knowledge of the comic. I'm sure there's plenty of people that saw that movie. Well, I don't think many people saw that movie. Let me amend that.
there's the real, you know, end result. Yeah.
Yeah.
There was a weird section in my Blockbuster, and that's how I saw it. So maybe that's
really was that what it was titled? Weird.
It was called Weird / Indie. I'm not even joking.
That's funny. Yeah,
I love it that those two get together. Anyway, that's I like that. I love that a lot. Fuck you, Blockbuster.
Well, I mean, I think most people that probably picked that movie up probably didn't know of the original Daniel Klaus comic, because that wasn't even like a... It was published in his like self-published 8-Ball series. It wasn't even like a standalone graphic novel or anything until after the movie came out. And I think that is an example of where a successful adaptation... An adaptation is successful because it's able to change the source material or deviate from the source material enough where Terry Zaikov, the director, was able to capture the tone of the story even if it changed the original comic away from, you know, what it was. So I think adaptation, you need to have that sort of change. And I just think a lot of big blockbuster movies, there's a hesitation to do that. Or if they do that, there's a fan backlash. So I think a smaller indie movie like Ghost World is an example of a very successful comic book adaptation.
See, what's interesting about that example is that Ghost World was released before the huge prevalence of discussion on the internet. You know, there was no Twitter, there wasn't Facebook, there was maybe, you know, forums that you could go to. And so if there was fan backlash, maybe it wasn't seen or heard at all. And that news media media sources definitely were not reporting on it, because it was just, oh, it was an internet forum and who can trust that?
You could maybe find it on IMDb, but they killed their message boards. Thanks a lot, guys.
I mean, that being said, I do agree with you, Paul. I think that movie works really well. I haven't read the graphic novel, like the collected edition, since I was in high school, so maybe I need to go back and see how they compare. But I remember liking the movie and liking the story, like, independently. Even though I knew that they were the same, it felt like they were two separate stories about the same thing, which is kind of interesting.
When you can, I think that is the mark of a successful adaptation, where it is something that you can watch, you can read the comic, you can see the movie, and they can exist as two different examples of the same thing. One's not trying to outdo the other, or feels like we're just going to take the comic and put it on the screen. It's like, no, we're actually going to change it and make it something unique and different while staying true to that spirit. So I think it's a really hard thing to pull off, and it's easier when it is a smaller indie type comic or story.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Another book that I feel like does that, or another movie I should say that does that, is the From Hell movie. I never read all of From Hell. I borrowed it from someone and then never finished it. It's a very long book. It's a very heavy book. But from what I read, the movie is a totally different thing. Totally different thing. Like, it's all about Jack the Ripper. Sure, Johnny Depp plays, you know, the key investigator. But other than that, it doesn't really feel like the same book. Maybe I'm wrong, but they totally went a different direction. The From Hell movie is okay. The From Hell book is very long.
I think we're on opposite ends of this, Mike, because I've actually read the book and I haven't seen the movie, but I know how the movie was received, and I've been on Wikipedia again. I mean, I'm always there researching, and I've read about the movie, and it's a great book, by the way, for those who are interested in, like,
I'm not trying to knock it.
History. Yeah.
And I think, well, that's an interesting example, because I think the problem of taking a book that's very dense and detailed.
How do you tackle something like that?
And how do you make that into a 2-hour movie? It's like, you can't, you know?
Like, that's like an ongoing series is what you would need for From Hell. You would need like a quality BBC, that's not a 2-hour movie. It's not going to happen.
Right.
But I think what you guys were getting at earlier, another sort of strength of these movies is that most people don't leave the theater of A History of Violence or A Road to Perdition. Although, I mean, obviously you wouldn't leave the theater. Those movies are really old. But you get my point. If you see those movies, you don't finish it and go, well, geez, you know, I have to go read the comic. You might not even go, well, geez, I wonder if there's a book based on this.
Oh, so, see, I did that, actually, for both of those movies.
Well, yeah, you're weird as hell. No one else
I am very weird, but I think I'm in the very, 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 very small minority. Yeah.
But nobody says, oh, I have to go pick up the book or I have to do whatever. And that's because with these comic book movies, you have a large amount of the audience, probably 8 out of 10, I'd probably say 9 out of 10, like, don't consistently read or really don't read comic books at all. And so, you know, they You know, you have some people that want to go home, buy the book, and draw a comparison. Whereas with something like Ghost World, you know, how many people read the book? So no one's going to be like, oh, this wasn't accurate or that wasn't accurate. I think what works so well about these adaptations is that for the large amount of people that are seeing these movies, they don't even know the other thing exists and there isn't like a natural connection to it. You know, most people that are know about one or the other just haven't even explored the other end of that spectrum.
And History of Violence is interesting too, because that's, I mean, it's a David Cronenberg movie, so you already have like a major respected director making a movie that kind of fits his oeuvre anyway, so you wouldn't think it's an adaptation to begin with.
Right.
So yeah. I mean, that's kind of an oddball in that sense.
It's the exact same thing with Scott Pilgrim and Edgar Wright. Like when you look at how Edgar Wright shoots movies and does visuals and his general tone and sense of humor and his way of is sort of equally mixing like gritty realism and fantasy, like Scott Pilgrim fits the bill. I mean, now, in the same vein, I think Scott Pilgrim managed to get a certain amount of publicity as a graphic novel to a point that I think a good amount of people were aware that it was a graphic novel, but maybe maybe not all.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, if you're into Edgar Wright movies, you're already in the know on that. Like that's probably some of that your stuff, jam already anyway. The Edgar Wright mindset. So.
See, what's interesting about History of Violence and even Road to Perdition, I love those two examples because I watched both of those movies and then I read both of the books, and the books and the movies are like completely different.
Really?
History of Violence goes so much further and there's so much more complexity to the story. And the same with Road to Perdition. Road to Perdition, like the movie only covers the first quarter of the story. And I'm kind of simplifying it, but it feels like the Road to Perdition only covers like a quarter of the story, because so much more mafia involvement, so much more discussion about all of the various things that this guy and his son did. And I mean, kudos to Tom Hanks and that I don't remember who the kid was in that movie for doing it, because I thought that that movie was pretty okay. I liked it, but the book was totally different animal. It's a lot read more like a noir story, and the movie didn't really have that feel.
Well, with something like From Hell, like we were talking about earlier, and like you were discussing with Road to Perdition, there inevitably becomes a point with a lot of these things, obviously not Ghost World because it was smaller, but with things like From Hell or Road to Perdition, you have to decide if you're going to tackle the whole thing or if you're going to make cuts or you know leave stuff on the cutting room floor. And with something with From Hell, like, I get it. You want to make a Jack the Ripper movie. Maybe these guys genuinely thought they could, you know, tackle all of From Hell. Maybe that was their just disillusionment. But like, if you just want to make a Jack the Ripper movie, just like do that. Like sometimes it feels like, why do you need? Okay, the cynical part of me realizes that like, if you go with something that's already been established as a brand and it's already been, you know, that it has some amount of name recognition, and you don't have to literally come up with a new title for things and everything, that there are benefits to that. But it's like, why do you need to go grab Alan Moore's like book if you're going to use so little of it?
Well, this way they don't have to write the net adaptation of the movie. Instead, the adaptation already exists.
I don't. It baffles me sometimes.
It's interesting because I think for these type of, we're kind of talking about sort of indie type stories and comics right now, and I think there's a whole discussion about other books, because as a child of the 90s, I definitely remember the small boom of comic book based movies from the 90s, like The Mask, Men in Black, The Phantom, all that stuff. But
yeah,
I think what's interesting about these small type movies we're talking about right now, like Ghost World, is that they come out of a genuine love for the source material. And I think when that comes through, that's what makes for a good movie. Like American Splendor. Again, I don't know how many people actually saw that movie, but there, I'm sure there are people that saw that movie. All right, I saw it six times, so that's all of them. It was just me. I don't know how many people. I'm sure most people saw the movie, maybe knew of Harvey Pekar, but I can't imagine many people. I can't imagine people going to see that movie because they wanted to see Paul Giamatti, or it looked quirky, or they got in for free, whatever, and not knowing anything about Harvey Pekar, they would get a really complete story from that movie because it was made out of love for the source material. Same thing with Ghost World and a recent film that just came out, My Friend Dahmer, which is based on the graphic novel by Dirk Backdurf.
Yeah.
And I don't know if what's interesting for me when I was watching My Friend Dahmer, you could tell that they really loved the comic, but I had this moment where there were certain scenes that I remembered from Durf's comic much more vividly than they came across on the movie screen. And I think there were other scenes that in the movie were far more disturbing than they were portrayed in the comic. It was kind of interesting to kind of compare the two in my head as I watched the movie. And I think I had a moment where I was watching that movie and I thought, well, this is a good movie, but it's just a movie about Jeffrey Dahmer, right? Because the book is about Durf Backdurf knowing Jeffrey Dahmer in high school and being the head of the Jeffrey Dahmer fan club in high school. And, you know, just knowing Jeffrey Dahmer as a teenager. The book feels much more like a memoir and a deeply personal story. Durf's artwork is very idiosyncratic and cartoony in a way.
Yeah.
And it creates a tension with the story. And I just felt like the comic came across much more nuanced. As much as I like the movie, there was something that just could not be captured by the filmmakers, even though they clearly loved the book and tried to like create this similar tone and feel. It was just missing that sort of personal take that the comic book had. And again, that's something you can only have with a sort of self-published indie comic that's one guy or one person drawing it and writing it. So it's kind of interesting, well, that distinction that I saw between the two.
Did they do narration in the movie?
No, and I think that was the one thing, because the comic is very much from Durf's point of view.
Yeah.
And the movie just kind of feels different, separate from that.
You heard it here first, folks. Films, just stop trying. Paul Jaisley, just knock it off. It's not working.
Comics are just better. Comics are just better.
You guys had like a century or a little century plus to figure it out. Just stop. Movies were done. In the same vein, I, as part of Nick White's quote-unquote research, I watched V for Vendetta a couple nights ago and then attempted to read the whole book before realizing that the book is huge.
It's labored.
And it's dense. Yeah. My goodness. No. And so I watched all the movie because like it's a movie. I can handle that part. I got that down pat. I've been working on that. And and I made it through about 80 or 90 pages of the book. And obviously, I think for me at least, and I know people feel this way frequently about Game of Thrones as well, I think the movie actually did a really good job of slimming down the cast and removing a lot of the superfluous characters. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Alan Moore wants to show you every little working cog and mechanic within this, I forget, I think it's called like Norse Wind or whatever the government's name is, the government fascist coalition.
Yeah.
And he wants to show you every working mechanism of it, which is fine. But they, in my mind, really adequately slim that down for the film while still retaining the idea that you've got this huge mechanism that's existing. And I thought they did a really good job with that. And obviously, I think most people also went into that movie perhaps not having any idea that they were watching a comic book movie, even though I would say that movie feels more quote-unquote conventional comic booky than others. If you if you read the book and you watch the movie, the V in the movie, at least for me, was more brutal, more driven to violence and violent acts, whereas the V in the book seemed to sometimes be a little bit more like he was like messing with his prey before killing it.
Yeah.
I don't know if you guys remember, but
which is worse?
Right. Well, he's like more like he's much more like waxing poetic, quite literally, and philosophical, and quoting Macbeth until the end. You know, in the book, and obviously, filmgoers are going to have a very low tolerance of that. But like when he kills the voice, you know, the guy who's basically like the Alex Jones of the movie, he literally, I think he just poisons him in the shower, or they find him dead in the shower, and that's and that's it. But in the book, you find out like this was the guy in charge of the camp that V was being tested on at. And minor spoilers for like a 1988 graphic novel, who cares? And so he kidnaps the guy and he dresses him up in a prisoner's outfit and he makes him Like, he has, like, a part of his house that's, like, looks like the camp that he was in, and he, you know, right. does this whole... I mean, it's very theatrical, which is fitting for how V is in the book. You know, he's sort of a showman, and everything is kind of, you know, very acted out. But in the movie, they're like, yeah, we're not going to make you believe that he kidnaps the guy and, you know,
well,
has playtime at the house, right?
I mean, in mm-hmm. the... But you got to, I think in the context of the movie, they wanted to save that big reveal for the end, yeah. right? They wanted that whole scene with Natalie Portman to be way more powerful. And I think if they had shown their hand early, it would have been like a
oh, you mean with kidnapping her when you yeah. find out that she was kidnapped by him. Yeah, yeah, to have that happen twice would be a little, you know, I have different rooms in my house set up for different, you know, theater plays yeah. I'm going to put yeah. on. Yeah, I see what you mean. And that's what I wrestled back and forth with a lot of different things, but it made a lot of the choices made sense. Like, of course, they aged up the role because I believe Natalie Portman's character was like 16 and was just yeah. like, you know, trying to prostitute herself at the beginning of the book. And in the movie, they make her like 20-something and she's working at the news propaganda agency. So they make that change. But you're like, well, why'd you do it? Well, there obviously are reasons about, you know, not being the film, not wanting to handle some of the more icky, gross, you know, shit about the real world that Alan Moore was, you know, showing. But also, by aging up Evie, he created a character who was capable of at least having some remembrance of what the world was like before everything changed, whereas Alan Moore's character actually was so young, if I remember all of this right, that she actually didn't, she had no knowledge. Right, well, exactly. Which yeah. made a very different character, and which made a very different, in some ways, a very different sort of developing story from there. So I thought it was interesting to see how they did some of those choices. And yeah. they, to each his own, they worked, you know? And that's right. that's a success yeah. story right there, when you make the adaptations that suit your story, especially in terms of time constraints. I mean, mm-hmm. that's the biggest one, of course, with all
yeah.
of those.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah. Oh, go ahead, Paul.
Well, I was going to talk about Judge Dredd, and
oh, absolutely, reason, go Dredd or Judge okay. Dredd, which or
well,
both,
I want to talk about one? Both because I think that's kind of, you know, I think we have two different topics here that are somewhat related. This idea that on one hand, for a successful adaptation, it has to be a pure love of the source material. On another hand, there's a desire to change it, streamline it, and make it more suitable for audiences. And I think your success or failure as an adaptation kind of falls between those two extremes in a way, because the Judge Dredd film that came out in the 90s starring Sylvester Stallone, I mean, is a terrible movie, but it would have been a terrible movie no matter what it was based on. You know, it was just kind of made for crass commercial success. You have Sly Stallone, who, you know, famously doesn't want to wear a mask, even though the whole point of Judge Dredd is he never seen without his helmet on.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. And this story is just convoluted. It does borrow enough from the source material to be somewhat interesting if you've read Judge Dredd. The fact that mm-hmm. Joe Dredd is a clone and he has a brother and all this stuff. But it's everything about
wait,
the
what?
Movies. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, do you know wait, Judge Dredd is a clone?
We oh, need some on, Judge really? Dredd history. Right. We need to not need
like,
to drop
I've
some
read,
knowledge.
I've read like the first like three. When is this revealed? Because I've like read at least the first three original collection volumes. Is this like later down the line?
I want to say it's pretty early. I mean, it's
well, you know. Yeah. Sorry, guys, take my geek card. We're done. It was nice.
Anyway, packing up shop. I guess, so if you don't know, Judge Dredd is a clone of the first judge. And then he has a brother named Rico. That's all in the. That's oddly all in the Sylvester Stallone movie. But anyway, that movie is clearly designed just to make money. And it's designed to make money in the late 90s. So it's over the top and corny.
Yeah.
And it doesn't quite fit. And what's interesting is that Dredd, the movie that came out, was it 2012 or 2015?
That's
maybe?
Right.
Yeah. The adaptation with Keith Urban. Not Keith Urban,
Carl
Urban.
Carl
Sorry.
Urban.
Not the
Keith Urban
country
would be
singer.
Great. Yeah. I would yeah.
Still Australian, but
right.
different job.
Well, yes. They must be brothers, right, Urban? So
right, yeah. right.
What's interesting is that movie I think is a far more successful movie. It's a fantastic action movie. I mean, it's one of the
right.
best action movies I've seen in a long time.
But is it that much of a Dredd movie?
Right, and that's the question. It's like it does stay true more or less to the what people think of a Judge Dredd comic, but Judge Dredd comics are very satirical and oftentimes very funny, mm-hmm. and there's no humor mm-hmm. in that movie. So I think that's a movie that someone that knows of Judge Dredd as a character but maybe hasn't read a bunch could watch and say, okay, that's a Judge Dredd movie. Not the Sly Stallone version, but Dredd. Mm-hmm. That's what I want from a Judge Dredd movie. And I really enjoyed it as a movie, but then I think it had to change enough of the comics to fit a modern audience's expectations of an action movie.
Right, which so ultimately it proved that trying to cater to an audience didn't really end up being Dredd's strength regardless.
Right, yeah. Exactly, yeah.
But, yeah. Well, I think what worked about that is they took one facet of Dredd and rolled with it, which, I mean, first off was obviously a real adherence to Dredd as a character, and I think they got that part totally right. And they got the brutality and, like, the grossness and, like, the sometimes unbelievably disgusting, like, mutated and disgusting violence of Dredd. They got that part down pat, too. But, and, it, I mean, there were some subtle nods, too. Like, I love how all the apartment blocks and buildings are named after fucking celebrities and shit. Like, they're not naming shit after, like, presidents anymore. It's like, you know, Dolly Parton Way or, you know, Elvis Block or whatever. And you saw, like, a little bit of that. Like, a little bit of that.
A little bit.
But not really. And I mean... Yeah. If this had been like a strictly British production, maybe they would have been tempted. But if you're going to try to sell this to Americans, not to blanket stereotype, but on the side of the Atlantic Ocean, we don't handle some of that stuff so well.
right. Yeah. So my question to you guys now is, you know, what movies were you surprised to find out were comics? Or are you just like in the know, on the pulse so hard that you're never surprised by these movies? Because I know there's a handful that like really shocked me that mm-hmm. I couldn't believe were comic books before they were movies. I mean, like to name a few just off the top of my head, or I should say in my notes, Mystery Men was a book that really surprised me was actually a comic book. Like it shouldn't surprise me because of how comic booky it is, but I just thought, what a cool movie idea. And then to find out that it was actually an older comic, was actually really cool to know that there was some lore that they based it off of. And I still love that movie to this day. But like that was a big surprise to me. Men in Black was another one.
Men in Black is huge.
Red was a surprise to me as well.
Yeah.
And I was even into comic books at that point. I didn't even realize that Red was a comic.
Same. Totally.
Did you guys have any?
Well, for when I was a kid, I was delighted to find out that there were actual Rocketeer comics that I could read because I loved that movie.
Oh,
when
nice.
I was a kid. And then also realized, wait, there's comics that aren't about Batman and Superman? What? So it's like this whole other world opened up in a weird way.
Right.
So
that was a surprise to me as a kid. That's allowed?
What? So that was kind of interesting. And then a more recent example is Diary of a Teenage Girl, which I went to go see. My girlfriend wanted to go see it, so we went and saw it. And it's an autobiographical story, but it's based on an autobiographical comic. So you actually see the girl sort of writing the comic that it's based on. So it becomes obvious that it's a comic, you know, while you're watching the movie.
I didn't know that.
But yeah, that's a fantastic movie, and I actually didn't know it was based on a comic until I saw it. And then, so that was a surprise. As tuned into the comics world as I am, I can still be surprised by that. So, yeah.
And Nick is silent because nothing surprises him.
Because nothing surprises him. Well, I mean, here's the thing, okay? Like, this is interesting. I find a lot of the non-superhero comics that are adapted into film tend to be overwhelmingly R-rated. A lot of them seem to be R-rated for subject content. And so when I was an age that it would have surprised me, like, my parents were not going to let me see Judge Dredd. Like, I know I was sheltered to the point of not seeing The Mask as a child.
Oh, boy.
You know, I was robbed of that experience.
Hey, that movie is tolerably bad, okay?
Yeah. So at a time when it would have surprised me, like I wasn't consuming those films anyway. But I mean, Men in Black for me is still like a big one. I mean, what's interesting about some of those is like Men in Black is literally based on like a comic that has like three issues to its name, which is kind of like fascinating. Mm-hmm. And even that they adapted real hard because like, I don't know if you've read much about the comic.
I haven't.
The agents are like way darker and like they don't mind white people. Like it's take no chances. Any witnesses or anybody are like getting killed. Like everybody's getting whacked.
Right.
So it's a way darker story from what I've heard. But that one is still one that I would consider like a bit of a surprise. I think it's possible that I think 300 I didn't know at the time as well.
Okay.
Like that was still at a point where I wasn't really, really into comics, and I probably saw some. I mean, the internet was still a big thing at that point, so I think I saw some stuff there. But otherwise, 300 was like, oh, that was a comic book. Okay. Now I have a movie and a comic book that I don't want to ever consume ever again. So, zing!
You got him.
Men in Black is kind of an interesting example because that was a hugely successful movie.
I mean, insanely successful.
But did they end up making two sequels to that?
Yeah they did. I haven't seen the third one yet.
I have. I've seen all three of them.
I mean, so that I think shows. How you can be successful in an adaptation in a very different sense as I was saying it before. Mm-hmm. Not a successful adaptation in adapting the source material, but successful in making money, which I guess is the most important thing for movies.
right.
So,
I mean, they made like three Mask movies, I'm pretty sure. None of them featured Jim Carrey after the first one.
Yeah.
I think only one that followed. Yeah, the first the Jamie one was, Kennedy.
Yeah, Jamie one, Kennedy.
Son of the Mask.
Son of Mask.
Which, I mean, that raises a whole other topic of discussion, so maybe I shouldn't mention it, but I'm going to anyway.
Go ahead.
Treating comics as just a source for intellectual property, I think.
Ooh. Oh, sure.
There's plenty of terrible books. I mean, the Phantom movie, there's plenty of examples from history that are
Tank
terrible
Girl.
Comic movies. Tank Girl. Well, I have a soft spot for Tank Girl.
I think you would.
Any movie that has both Ice-T and Iggy Pop in it, I'm going to have to love.
Okay. Well, I'll put my neck on the line as well. I don't think Constantine is that bad of a movie, people. Honestly.
See, it's got that guy who always plays Russian dudes in it, and I fucking
Stramare,
love that guy.
Peter Stramare.
Sure. I don't know what his name is.
The devil. Yeah.
He's just always the Russian. I fucking love that guy.
And it's got Tilda Swinton in it too. I don't think that movie is terrible. Like it's a solid like 5 or 6 for me, but it's not like a 3. Okay.
Yeah. It's not R.I.P.D. level. Did you guys ever?
I haven't seen that, but I've heard. Okay. I've heard things.
Yeah. I did. Don't watch it.
Well, I mean, that speaks to the point I was making. This idea of it just serving. Treating comics as a source of, property. It was like, Jonah Hex, clearly no one who made Jonah Hex cared about that character or the comic at all.
So
right.
Sad.
I mean, just, right. And which is kind of a shame. And I think I'm at this point now where I can see a trailer for a movie and basically say, I bet there's a Mark Miller comic that's based on.
Oh,
so
God.
When I see the trailer for
this is so sad, but so true.
I bet that's a comic, and I bet I know who wrote it. So.
Yeah, well, I mean, here's the other side of that coin, though. Some people are writing comics to make them into movies.
Exactly.
Let's look at what Mark Miller's done. I mean, and I don't mean to shit on him. He's just the person to think of right now. The Kingsman
Sorry, you've
book.
Got the bullseye on your back. Sorry you have all the money. Sorry.
So what's interesting about Kingsman, and I'll bring this up because there's a sequel movie that just came out or is coming out.
Yeah.
A few months back.
Yeah, it came out. So Kingsman, that book, I was buying it when it came out. And because I knew it was like Dave Gibbons and Mark Millar, and I was like, shit, yeah, like let's do this. I was willing to give that a try because I was still riding Kick-Ass 2, thinking, okay,
edgy
maybe
little
this isn't
fuck.
That bad.
Yeah.
I was, oh yeah, supreme edgelord. No, I mean, like, don't get me wrong, like Mark Millar's books, they satisfy some sort of visceral need for like blood and guts and over the
primal,
top violence.
Terrible urges, sure.
Right, and it's. And by no means are they all good. And Kingsman was a very convoluted book.
I don't think anyone's going to think we were going to go there, Mike.
Yeah, okay. So, well, anyway, but Kingsman was like a very convoluted book. And the fact they were making it into a movie had me really on edge because I was confused how they were going to get all this licensed bullshit that Mark Millar threw into the whole book. Like, he threw so much licensed stuff into the story, like, just with, like, sideways referencing and stuff. And it seemed weird that they were going to adapt it. And so, when I saw the adaptation, I was like, oh, this makes way more sense than the comic, and the movie's better than the comic, hands down. Like, it's like the Fight Club book, it's like Fight Club. The Fight Club movie is better than the book. That's right. Just plain and simple. So to see that they're doing a sequel and then they're doing a follow-up book is kind of interesting. I don't know if this is Mark Miller's way of trying to bring people back to comics from movies, because if it is, I really like that. Yeah. If it's not, if it's just him trying to say, look, you can greenlight all my other books, like, that's like, it's like,
well, he's launching book as part of his Netflix deal. He's launching books with Netflix as the publisher.
Right. Which is really interesting
to
see totally where that's going to go, because that I think that that may be a step in a cool direction, maybe not the right direction, but a cool direction in terms of promoting comics along with the content that that they're based off of.
Yeah. It might not be the guy I want doing it, but I think this is the step that could actually genuinely try to merge like comic and you know, TV narrative in a way that might actually not feel superficial and flimsy.
Yeah. Yeah. Because, I mean, we did the whole episode of, you know, talking about the adapted versions of movies and stuff like that as comics. And, I don't think I can think of any of those outside of that one Star Wars book that everyone references and says is great, that Greg Rucka did, that do a good job of adapting a movie or a TV show in a serialized comic form or even just a collected edition form. It's really tough to think of any that actually work. And so if Mark Millar's trying to actually, you know, sidestep that and say, let's do this side by side, get a new issue with every episode or something, I think that's a really cool way to encourage people to read more comics. And that's only beneficial for the medium.
Right. And for us, right, to talk about them.
So. And for us to talk shit about Mark Millar even more.
I mean, that interview is never happening.
Though. I don't mean to like totally like bag on the guy, because you know, he's done, I think, a lot to make comic books more mainstream, and that's beneficial to a certain extent. If it's getting someone in the door of reading comics, I think that's a positive step.
Right. Right. Yeah.
I think for a lot of people like ourselves, and if you like Mark Millar, that's fine. That's totally fine. But I think some of us see him as a stepping stone of taste. It's something, you know, you genuinely liked and enjoyed at one point, but maybe you don't really like anymore. On that note, there's a new Kick-Ass on the way. I just bought previews yesterday.
Oh yeah, I saw that.
Get psyched.
Okay. Well, you know, I think we've kind of maybe talked as much as we could talk without going into any further deep analyzation of other movies and stuff. So let's wrap this up. Let's talk about where people can find us on the internet. Let's start with you, Nick.
You can find me on Twitter at Death Star Plans. That's pretty much it. That's how I like it.
What about you, Paul?
I'm on Twitter at OhHiPauly. You can also hear me talk about professional wrestling on the Spike Pile Driver podcast. We're on Twitter at Spike Pile Pod.
You can find me on Twitter at Mike Rappin, and you can follow the show at IRCB Podcast. We retweet a bunch of random things and like things at 3 in the morning. It's my favorite time to be on Twitter. And we post a poll every Friday, such as the one I posted this week, who is the best sidekick? The answers will surprise you, and who's winning will surprise you even more. I'll just say that.
Sounds great. I still have to vote, so I'll have to go check that out. You can also find our Goodreads group. We do a monthly Goodreads episode, and we have a whole Goodreads group run by the wonderful Kate on the site. We have weekly threads. We discuss comics we've been reading. You can vote for Book of the Month and all that. Lots of fun over there on Goodreads. You can also go to our website, ircbpodcast.com. We post links to the episodes, our weekly poll lists, and other stuff, show notes, all that over there.
In addition, please rate, subscribe, and tell your friends. If you go to the iTunes page where our show is featured, you can go and give us a rating there. And at least from what they've told us, it matters and it's greatly important.
Totally. It really is. I mean, like, if you're rating our show and writing reviews, I mean, if you leave a review, we'll read it on the air. Just do that. Go there, say how much you love the show. Or how much you don't love the show, and we'll read it on the air.
That seems a little open-ended, but you know, let's do it. That's fine.
I'm willing to try it.
Yeah. Let's try new things. You can also email the show, ircb@destroythesaib.org. Please reach out. We do love talking to you.
Yeah, Infinity Shred does all the music for the show. They're the absolute best band in the universe. Xander he's a beautiful man. Just a beautiful boy. Love him to death. He edits the show. He's a fantastic person, and I'm going to play D&D with him later tonight. I'm so excited.
Awesome.
Finally, I want to say thank you to everyone for listening. Thank you to all of our Kickstarter backers. We're getting everything in order. All of the stuff is on its way to my house. I'm super excited about the t-shirts and the special new stickers I ordered, and the pins and another special thing that I did. So get ready for that. If you want to get some Kickstarter swag, you know, reach out to the show. Maybe we can make something happen. But until next time, we will check you later. And thank you so much for listening.
See that the initial reviews of Star Wars are rolling in?
Yeah, I had to mute. I muted so many things. Like, I did not want this fucking movie spoiled. Please.
Yeah. I usually don't care about spoilers too much, but yeah, this one I definitely want to go in pretty much fresh, so.
Yeah, see, I mean, I'm so confused and conflicted.
I mean, I watched the trailers. I know there's plenty of people that I know that avoided even the trailers themselves. So,
yeah, I can understand that.
But yeah, I probably skipped some reviews.
I don't think I'm gonna I mean, like, what are they gonna say? Oh, it was pretty fucking good. Like, come on.
It's gonna be great. We know it's gonna be great.
It's Star Wars. Like, yeah. Nick, are you back? He's not.
He's not back.
Yeah, I just want to see Star Wars. Like, that's all I want to do.
That's literally the only thing I would do. I still haven't gotten tickets yet. I don't know when I'm going to go.
Oh, man.
Maybe like a Sunday matinee. I don't want to deal with crowds. And
Yeah. But you have to see it, like, the opening weekend, right? Or at least, like, right. Maybe you see, like, a Monday night showing, you know?
Okay, that might be perfect next Monday.
Just because, like, the sooner you see it, the less you have to worry about.
That's right.
Yeah. So it's like when Harry Potter 6 came out, which is a whole other thing. I was spoiled by that book. Like, I was one of those people that got a friend of mine in high school. I shouldn't say friend. This guy that I went to high school with. Harry Potter came out. I got home at, like, 2 in the morning because I opened to the midnight release, right? Because I was that kid. And he sends me an instant message. He's like, "Hey, Mike, what's going on?" And I was like, "Oh, you know, just reading Harry Potter." He's like, "Oh, cool. Go to page 671. And I was like, "What?" He's like, "Yeah, Snape kills Dumbledore." And I was like, "Get the fuck out of here." And he was right. And I was so mad.
That's funny.
I mean, I don't know. I remember, you know, like when Force Awakens came out, I didn't feel like there was any worry of spoiler.
Yeah.
You know, like, because there could have been. They could have revealed a lot of stuff.
I felt like, yeah, definitely the marketing for that movie. Listen, the marketing for that movie was all about nostalgia. Like, all of the trailers were just like, we're going to play the John Williams score. We're going to have some slow shots of X-Wing fighters fighting.
Yeah.
Isn't that what you want? And it is what I wanted. It's exactly what I want. But I feel like this one, they're actually like, all right, now actually going to tell a new Star Wars story instead of just relying on nostalgia.
Back.
Welcome back.
Welcome back. We were just talking about all the spoilers we want to avoid for the new Star Wars movie.
Oh, I mean, I haven't seen any of the trailer stuff. Like, none of it. So.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Oh, okay. Interesting.
I saw somebody earlier today, I think it was Kate Leff, said that she had something from Star Wars spoiled, like, right in her timeline. And I was like, oh, God. Put me on high alert.
Yeah, I know some people are, like, already pre-blocking, like, Star Wars hashtags and shit.
Yeah. Anyway, so, Nick, you finished the War of Riddles and Jokes and Riddles, or whatever it was called. What happened? What did you think that was not good about it? Or, like, worrisome? Because he was just telling the story to Catwoman to be like, one time I did a bad thing, Cat.
One time, Scott Snyder wrote Zero Year, and we need to justify its existence real bad by revisiting that shit.
See, what makes no sense about that storyline, then, is the fact that in Zero Year, Batman felt super inexperienced, and then in the War of Jokes and Riddles, he felt like regular Batman. I didn't feel inexperience.
I'm trying to remember when I think they mentioned when it takes place, the War of Jokes and Riddles. Isn't it like a couple years after Zero Year?
Oh, it might be.
So,
well, because, like, this new Batman, like, because the current Batman timeline is supposed to take place 5 years after he becomes Batman or something?
Something like that. Well, I don't know.
I thought War of Jokes and Riddles was not supposed to be that far removed from Zero Year.
Well, because he says he said at the beginning it was like right after, very soon after he had become the Batman. That, I think that's how it opened.
Okay.
So anyways, Nick, you had a problem with the conclusion of that arc.
Right. So let's make sure, maybe I misunderstood it, but the end result is that literally everything, and by everything I mean an insane amount of calculating and planning, went into the Riddler attempting to make the Joker laugh.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, right. That was their whole steal, their whole shtick from the beginning, was that the Joker couldn't laugh at anything, and the Riddler had solved every puzzle.
Right.
Or every riddle, or that's what they thought. And they figured that the last riddle and the last joke was the other.
Right.
Right.
So...
I mean, the thing that survived at the end of it was that did Batman kill the Riddler? Is that what happened at the end?
Oh man, now I'm trying to remember this right.
No, that's not what happened.
Damn it!
I think
he nearly kills him. I'm trying to remember who stops him from doing it, or what stops him from doing it.
Isn't it Kite Man? Because the whole thing actually turns out to be a Kite Man origin story.
Kite Man gets knocked out. Kite Man gets knocked out before the final.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah, it's not Kite Man.
All right, I'm pulling it up right now. Hold on a second.
Something else stops him.
Which was this? Was it issue 30? What was the last issue? 32?
Oh, he's going to stab the Riddler, and then Joker puts out his hand, and Batman ends up stabbing Joker through the hand.
That's right.
That's what it is.
That's right.
Oh, yeah, he was gonna kill him, and the joke was that even the Batman could be pushed to that limit. And the funny thing was that the Joker, the Joker thought that was funny that Batman could be pushed to that level. Okay. I mean, right. I thought that was a good, Batman's whole problem is that, he was gonna kill someone without...
Right.
Yeah, so, I mean, I think that that's serious. It's to show that he can lose that restraint.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think do you consider that whole sequence to be an unintended consequence that the Riddler didn't plan on, or that he planned the whole thing all the way through that too, and the Riddler is just that much of a genius as well?
I mean, my thought was that the Riddler didn't think that he could push Batman that far.
Yeah. Right, that was just a non-intended consequence, perhaps. I mean, beyond that, it's kind of tough to... I don't know. On one hand, I'm like, wow, the Riddler is this is crazy that he's obsessed and fixated to this point, but then again, he is the Riddler, and so he'll literally go down that rabbit hole as far as he needs to, and ends justify the means, really. So I guess in that sense, maybe... Like I said, in that sense, it's sort of... While it feels like petty and stupid, on the other side, for him, mind games and riddles are pretty much everything. So yeah, you will end up poisoning a kid if you end up getting where you need to be.
Yeah,
I think that's the hurdle that I was trying to get over.
I think the whole arc was maybe two issues too long.
I agree.
My major critique.
And I'm not even going to say that in the vein of those two Kite Man, Clayman drawn issues were the problem. I liked those. I thought
me too.
Same.
I thought those were the best two issues, honestly. But yeah, in other ways it felt padded. I mean, thank you, double shipping. I mean, if you want to point to another thing where it's double shipping, maybe not the best thing ever. I would point to that for sure. I just hope we get more Kite Man, one way or another.
Well, he's already made it a thing in his run. That's going to be the thing that gets remembered out of this run is going to be Kite Man joke, you know? Yeah. Oh, I thought that it was, when he did it, when it happened the first time, I was like, that's actually funny. And then it happened a second time, I'm like, callback, nice. And then he did a fucking origin story, I was like, oh man, this arc is just about, this whole run is just about Kite Man.
Exactly, yep.
I mean, I will say I am liking Clayman on art, but then again, I'm biased because I fucking love Clayman's art.
Issue 36 is a beautiful book, and I think, Nyuki, you have to read that right away, because, fuck, that's a great issue.
Dude, yeah, you could read that without having, well, you have to read the whole Catwoman arc, I guess.
It's kind of a standalone, right? I mean, it follows the Joelle Jones arc, but it's sort of a thing apart as well.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, goddamn, like, I seriously was reading that issue and, like, laughing my ass off at how perfect... It just is so well crafted that, I mean, in a way that was predictive, and because you know the trope, you know how this is going to work out, and it's just fantastic.
Yeah.
Phew. All right. We could do a whole 36 episode at this point. Yeah. Xander, I'm going to trust you to just cut up whatever you think is necessary there.
he just cuts the whole thing.
Right. Yeah.